Okay, hello and welcome. I'm Jennifer Wolf, content partner at NAB Amplify, the media platform designed to provide resources and education and help connect the NAB community throughout the year. Thank you for joining us today to explore what intelligent content means for the future of the media and entertainment industry, and a big thank you as well to today's event sponsor, Cognizant. So, intelligent content, as you know, encompasses all things data, AI, and automation. These technologies are driving an industry-wide transformation, enabling customized, immersive content. And over the past few months, including during the 2022 NAB show, we've explored what intelligent content actually means and how it can help us as creative entities or content creators. And we've also explored how to connect to audiences and how to make money using intelligent content. So today, we have some terrific speakers joining us to discuss how we can use intelligent content to keep the industry in check, increase accountability, and make sure we're working in an ethical landscape. So I'm just going to run through our list of speakers today, and then I'll give each one of them a chance to introduce themselves and talk a little bit about what they do in relation to intelligent content. So we have Chad Andrews with Cognizant, AVP and consulting partner. We have Stephanie H. Dean, PhD. She's assistant professor of mass communication at the University of Montebello. Guy Finley, president and CEO of Mesa. Megan Glenn, media sales director at Flowcode, and Ling Ling Sun, chief technology officer at Nebraska Public Media. So thank you all of you for joining us today. Really excited to get this going. Chad, you want to tell us a little bit about your role?
Yeah, sure. Thank you. Really appreciate the chance to be here today. So I'm now in my third week at Cognizant as a partner in the consulting practice and the communications, media, and technology practice. And I come here after 9 years at IBM, where I was in media and entertainment consulting, and also was the global solutions lead for cloud video and then advertising, and did a stint leading our blockchain for media strategy as well. And then prior to that, the first half of my career, I co-founded a post-production services company. We were called Orbit Digital. We're based in LA and New York, and I ran the LA division. So safe to say, in my 28-year career, it's been dominated by media and entertainment technology. And then a good portion of that was around process. Used to be that post-production, visual effects, production were in completely siloed processes. I was sort of part of the early days when those started to merge around an IT background. And of course, metadata and the data from camera into the entire supply chain was a big part of what we did, and that's only grown in importance as it's sort of become intelligent content. So at Cognizant, again, I'm relatively new to the practice, but I know that we've had several engagements with large clients. I'm not sure if I can reference them or not, but where we take care of the back-end media supply chain process, where we are responsible for automating the generation of various metadata in that supply chain and ensuring that that's being used for consumption at the application layer.
Great. Thank you, Chad, and welcome. Stephanie, do you want to tell us a little bit about your role at University of Montebello?
Hi, thank you. Thank you for having me. Sure. So I am an assistant professor at University of Montebello, fairly new there. I've also been at MTSU where I started the Immersive Storytelling Lab. And in this lab, what we're really working with is how students tell media across different platforms, different genres, and how to not then re-reproduce, sorry, re-reproduce in screen English there. I'm 15 years in Sweden, so now I'm fluent in Swenglish. how we end up accidentally reproducing biases that we may not even realize that we have into the media that we're creating, because what media is really a reflection of our own thoughts, ideas, wishes, dreams, that kind of thing. So what then that says about our thought processes and our identities and what kind of biases we may be inserting into that, and how to look at that both through a media lens, but also linguistically, and kind of through this lens of digital humanities. So I teach a bunch of different classes in production, in media law, in kind of a Jill of all trades where I am now. But that's the gist of it.
Wonderful. Thank you, Stephanie, and thank you so much for joining us. Guy Finley, tell us about you and your role at Mesa.
Sure, absolutely. So MESA used to stand for, it still does, but we don't brand as it, the Media and Entertainment Services Alliance. We were founded in 2008. And essentially, we are the vendors to the media and entertainment community across movies, television, games, software, et cetera. We focus on three core verticals, which is data. And we have a smart content vertical. I've worked with NAB for years. So we've been tracking together and they kind of elevated it by calling it intelligent content. But we've been working with smart content for 8 years. And that's really also where our metadata practice is and was. And we really try to drive the vendor perspective in terms of engaging with their customers to utilize emerging technologies in a more sound way. So, you know, the idea of doing things in email and on spreadsheets has evolved to where we're working on platforms and trying to be a little bit more collaborative in our process. But we do it across data, which is obviously this phone call and this meeting, but also IT, which we rebranded from information technology to innovation and transformation, and also security as well, which plays into intelligent content. As the content gets smarter, moving through these chains, security becomes a different issue than kind of how, as Chad was mentioning, working in, you know, 10 years ago in post, a lot of these things were siloed, not connected. Obviously, things change when intelligent content is connected to the network all the time. Similarly, also our latest vertical has to do with building data centers for all the virtual production that is happening, and really how our industry is really transforming into needing these types of small data centers inside of your facility just to deal with the amount of data, because you're talking on these new intelligent sets, smart sets, you're talking about sometimes 30 to 50 different devices all communicating, interoperating together along with the personnel that is charged to operate them as well. Mm-hmm. So it's becoming just a much more collaborative business, and that's where MESA really starts. Let the collaboration begin was how we launched it. And then we're now into bringing ideas into action. So moving our industry forward as fast as we can, but without breaking things along the way.
Mm, good point. So Megan, tell us a little bit about your role at Flowcode and how Flowcode ties in with the idea of intelligent content.
Yeah, hi. Super excited to be here. I actually have the luxury of being a technology that kind of serves as an entry point to smart tech. I actually work with publishers, content creators, networks, and basically media orgs to create interactive media, specifically focusing in TV at the moment. And yeah, I mean, we are essentially an audience engagement, measurement, and attribution tool hidden behind highly designed QR codes. And we are a company that focuses a lot in, you know, basically bringing the human element into media delivery and measurement. And before this, I was at WGN-TV in Chicago and Nexstar Station, and my background is primarily in digital media sales for media companies.
Terrific. Well, Megan, thank you. And thank you for joining us today. And finally, we have Lingling Sun, Chief Technology Officer at Nebraska Public Media. Lingling, please say hello and tell us about your role.
Yeah, hello. This is Lingling Sun, and I'm a Chief Technology Officer at Nebraska Public Media. Nebraska Public Media is a state network, so we produce local content and covering news, sports, education, and culture, and also cover the state legislature, and distribute the programming, including PBS and NPR programming through over-the-air traditional broadcast and through internet-based online multi-platforms. So my role is to lead Nebraska Public Media Technology Advancement. So back to you, Jennifer.
Thank you so much for joining us today, Lingling. And I think working as you do in a role that serves the public, you will have some really terrific insights about today's topic. For those of you just joining us, we're here today to explore how we can use intelligent content to keep the industry in check, increase accountability, and make sure we're working in an ethical landscape. You know, so the big question is, how do we utilize intelligent content for a better future? And to kick off, let's talk about how can we use intelligent content to keep the industry in check, increase accountability, and make sure we are truly working what we can call an ethical landscape. Guy, do you maybe want to jump in and kick things off?
Sure. You know, I, and by the way, thank you not only to you but to Emma in the background and EB show. You know, thanks for putting this together, and it's always a stimulating conversation when you got such great experts. And a lot of organizations have just come to this in the last couple of years. It's not as if we've ignored it, you know, but the idea of data journey, data governance, you know, data stewardship, you know, it in the quote unquote old, I'm putting air quotes in the air, sorry, we're on Twitter. But in the old days, right, in old Hollywood, it was always an afterthought. And a lot of times we would rebuild it afterwards, even the descriptive metadata for shows that you know, international content owners would produce. You know, they would blow it off and just buy it at the end and be like, oh, I'd rather go to one of my service providers that does this for a living, because who am I to make these choices myself? I produce movie, produce television. But I think the core, you know, tenet for intelligent content is, no, you're a media company. And I think what really flipped the switch was as we started into the streaming business, the global streaming business, it made people realize like, oh, that's right. Now I have a direct relationship with the customer. And I think that's ultimately what really changed to drive intelligent content was that direct to consumer relationship in distribution. Mm-hmm. But it made you rethink things where it's like, well, let's get back up to the mouth of the river and do this properly. And I think that's really been the explosion in the last couple of years, realizing it's never too early to start your data journey. It's just about assembling the right pieces, the right teams. You know, where does it matter? And that's probably a good place also for where some of our experts can talk, because it's across advertising, it's across onboarding, it's across internal. All of this content does, when we make it smarter, is help our human workers do their job better and enable us to be able to automate things that, honestly, they already know it's a pain in the, you know, whatever part of their job, the tedious and mindless work that we have to do as humans to keep it going. So, you know, I think it really what it comes down to is when you start saying let's embrace intelligent content, you have to start thinking about your overall strategy around data. And like I said, that could be a good conversation starter for us in terms of how these companies do it. And ultimately, you know, Ling, you as a practitioner, you know, inside of an organization, that's obviously top, also a much bigger national picture, if not international as well. I think it only makes all your jobs easier in line, but certainly more difficult in the short term.
And thank you for bringing up Ling, because I was about to turn to you and ask you, you know, from your perspective, after hearing what Guy's talking about from an industry perspective, Ling, what are some of the things we can do to use intelligent content to help keep the industry in check?
So that's really a good question. You know, when we think about to keep the industry in check, and first we should understand and have clear goals of ourselves and what we want to achieve with, the intelligent content. And, we understand that we created content, you know, have a better goals for education and for covering the right news and to reach out to our audience, serve the audience, and then think about the intelligent content and use available tools and to help us to achieve our goals. I think that's the part we should keep in mind even when talking about using automation, using AI, or using data. We don't want to have this bi-directional, have feedback coming from data analysis, then make our decision and reach our goals. I think that's the part, and we sometimes just focus on more about technology, but forget our ultimate goal and forget about our services and who our citizens and who our audiences are. So that's something I think is more clear when we talk about intelligent content and use it to serve our purpose.
Stephanie, this seems like it might be a good point for you to jump in, because we're talking about how we're choosing what we're serving to communities.
Yeah, definitely. I was furiously scribbling notes when both Guy and Ling were speaking, because I agree with a lot of what they're saying, that we have to think about this not just from the media company perspective, but the fact that we're telling stories. And stories is how we learn and engage with culture. I mean, it's more than we're getting media out there. We're engaging and we're creating culture with these stories. So I think Ling, what she said about how we use how we need to think about the clear goals, what are the goals of the stories that we're telling, and does the analysis of this intelligent content, because at the end of the day, at least right now, we're not to an AI point where the AI is conscious, right? It's not making its own decisions yet. We're programming in algorithms. So at this point we are in right now with AI, we're talking algorithms, and we are coding our own ideals into these algorithms. So does the story that we're telling at the end of the day meet our business goals, meet our business ideas? Does the analysis support what we're trying to do? And I think Ling hit the proverbial nail on the head by saying we need to analyze then. We need to go actually look at the media that we're creating. What is it saying? And does it meet the goals and standards that we're asking it to?
I totally agree.
And Megan is kind of... Okay. Go ahead.
Sorry, it broke up.
So I was going to say, I totally agree. I agree with your position as well. And you know, the one thing that to reinforce also, as I think it also hits in terms.
Guy, you're kind of cutting in and out.
Oh, my apologies. Sorry, can you hear me now?
Yes, absolutely.
And my apologies if I'm chopping in and out. That might have been my cheek hit the mute button. I was going to say also it's important when we're building these frameworks. What is data? Right? Data allows us to make better informed decisions. And I think that's ultimately, Steph, where you really come into play is don't allow us to utilize that data in an unethical way to make an informed decision that may not be based on truth or reality. It may be skewed and bent because the algorithm sent us down the wrong path. And that's where I thought maybe also, Megan, in terms of what your work was doing, that it might pull you into the conversation as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm like bouncing on my hands over here because this is kind of exactly the space that we're operating in. You know, again, we come to the idea of, you know, automated content delivery and making content assumptions via algorithms, but ultimately, like, what is the measure of success? And that's real human engagement. And, you know, I have this scope of being kind of media adjacent with this measurement tool. And ultimately, you know, when we're gauging the success of content or understanding the resonance of content, the best way to see that is ultimately to measure response. And, you know, so you have this approach to, a bespoke content experience, and how do you gauge whether or not, your end user is actually interested? You know, you can't accidentally scan a flow code. That's the thing that we always say. So, you know, it's a real human being on the other side of that algorithmic delivery. And when you think about, you know, I love the idea of using content to tell a story or create a culture, because when you really think about some of the more creative applications of things like QR tech and smart content, it's truly interactive, right? So it's not just one-sided storytelling, the way the industry has kind of been a sit-back and very passive delivery method. This gives the opportunity for users to further engage with the content that they're seeing, whether it's learning more or making a purchase or, you know, accessing additional information. And, you know, this is obviously a really powerful tool when it comes to undoing cultural biases that are sometimes prevalent in media. But, you know, also from a practical standpoint, when we talk about data collection and measurement and ultimately monetizing, having that cross-platform experience, really interactive back and forth between the content and the viewer, paired with some really nicely strategically placed first-party data capture opportunities and things, that not only like really creates an optimal content experience for the viewer, but ultimately you're getting a lot of really powerful insights into who that person is, what types of content they prefer, and really how to optimize even when you're already looking at optimized delivery.
Thank you. I just want to add onto what Megan said. You know, talking about feedback. So for broadcasters, we've been doing this for quite a while. I use Nielsen rating as an example, and I've been seeking feedback from viewers, and then help us to make a program better and make a decision. So now with the AI, with the data, with the automation, so this help us to do it more directly and more fast. It's faster and more inclusive. So give us tools to target our audience and provide precision of programming services to our audiences. So this is really a game changer. So back to you, Jennifer.
Thank you, Ling Ling. And Chad, we'd love to hear from you a little bit on how we can use intelligent content to help keep things in check.
Sure. You know, when I think of intelligent content, you know, I think of the pragmatic reasons why you would want to have more data capture throughout the process. And, you know, they become kind of corporate drivers like monetization and the ability to assist in curation. But the thing that matters to me is, that really I think is important about intelligent content is we're a programmable species and we're inundated with information. Now we're predisposed to storytelling and narratives, but they can really shape where we go as a society, even how we govern ourselves. So I think the optimist in me thinks that we can take an active hand in how we use content for good, to not just tell better stories, but to help ourselves become educated and rooted in truth. Now, the other side of that coin is that we're seeing more often that the programmability of our minds is being exploited through content. And as Guy mentioned, the algorithms that are driving us towards various types of agenda, even if that agenda is just sensationalism and increased consumption based on maybe our darker angles. But I think these things have huge stakes. You know, if you just look back at the last 10 years or so, doesn't matter where you live in a political spectrum, I think you can see that we've been divided at the same time as our consumption of content has skyrocketed. And, you know, we're about to have some more dystopian problems kind of stacked on top of that, like deep fakes and the inability to really know whether media is real when it represents perhaps even, you know, a political leader or a person having said or done something. So to me, there's again, that the high stakes around intelligent content is rooted in a responsibility I think we all have in owning the direction of our lives and our impact on others through information and content. So I think it's that high of stakes for me. Like when we're talking about, it's not something as mundane as capturing data so that we can, you know, increase the, you know, the revenue around a piece of content by 5%. To me, we have to do something as a collective species around the way that we are assimilating information and thinking critically around it. And I'm hoping that intelligent content is one of the mechanisms that will help us to evolve out of what's really been sort of a difficult few years in the way that we've managed the huge influx and increase in content consumption at the same time as we've had to adapt and respond as a culture to it.
Thank you, Chad. So for those of you just joining us, we're here today to explore how we can intelligent content to keep the industry in check, increase accountability, and make sure we're working in an ethical landscape. And Chad, you're talking about the high stakes intelligent content presents, and that kind of brings us to talking about what are some of the biggest ethical implications of intelligent content. And Stephanie, I think you were about to break in.
Yes.
And I'd love to have you address this as well.
Yeah, Chad, you are singing my song over there. I completely agree with the fact that, research is upholding that, this fact that we are, you know, this programmable and easily manipulated species. Howard Rheingold, quite some time ago now, came up with this idea of 21st century literacies, and that we need to start learning how, or teaching in schools formally, how we are learning and consuming now, and we're not doing that. We're still teaching reading and writing in this long form method that doesn't really coincide with how we consume information now. And so finding formalized ways to educate that around this 21st century literacy, the ability to critically consume data, the ability to look at truth claims and to figure out who is actually giving you this information, and are they someone that you should spend your time and attention on, because we know those are very limited resources. So starting to speak about this in a way that this is a new literacy that we need to formalize and teach to our kids and our students, I think is an important part of that, because we are, and it has shown everything, not just of course Facebook, which has gone all the way to the Supreme Court where they've been, you know, discussing their algorithms, but even Amazon, you know, if you read this, then you might like this book, and how more kind of conspiracy and sensational topics and titles start popping up because we click on them more easily. So it's definitely an important thing that I think is rooted in this idea of intelligent content, but also how we train our algorithms. Our algorithms at the end of the day are a shallow mirror of the people programming them. I know I've said that I think 3 times now, but we've got to really start looking at the people behind the algorithm. And one thing, going back to what Guy said that I don't think I mentioned earlier that I highlighted in my notes, is assemble the right teams. We have to have everybody on that team. We have to have everyone represent, I'm sorry if you can hear my dog snoring, he snores very loud. We have to have everyone represented on that team, so all these voices are heard. That will make such a big difference in the way these stories are told, and highlighting implicit biases that we may not realize that we have. We're not doing it to be evil or bad. Well, hopefully we're not doing it to be evil or bad. Again, the utopian idea comes out that we're doing this to just tell stories. We may not realize we have a bias that we may have.
I was also going to jump in there, Steph, and just pile on, because I think also what you say speaks also to what Ling Ling said, which is, now that we're no longer relying on third parties, because that's what we've done so for so long in the M&E industry, this is about your own team's culture and your own company's culture as well. And I, you know, knowing also the different kind of cultures within just Hollywood itself, and this applies to any industry, any business, right? Chase is different from Citibank, even though they're both banks, right? But the idea where we'll have a better hands-on approach as a company going in and saying, oh, these tools are for me. So you really look at it, because I was going to also say the other flip side is we talk a lot about consumer engagement and interaction, and I do have a comment about that as well. But you kind of look at this as we're also building algorithms to gauge the performance of our teams, and, you know, how are our remote workers doing, because we don't get to see them every day, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It really speaks to, we're building a new foundation for how our business will operate. And that also speaks to what Chad was talking about the future opportunities. You know, we're so busy struggling now with kind of the CPM mentality, and Megan, you could probably speak to that as well, right? But the idea that we built all these businesses around our existing web culture right now, but that web culture is also evolving, just as our storytelling is evolving with better technology. So it really says this is the topic to be talking about now, because if you're not engaged in talking about this now, you're going to be lost in 6, 12, 18 months when it's really going to matter inside of your company.
Guy, it's funny that you say the impressions comment, because literally one of our standard kind of go-tos, just speaking to the idea of holding ourselves to these pre-existing measurement tools. You know, I say all the time, we make TV clickable, right? And like, I mean, ultimately that kind of boils us down to being in the same category. But I think, you know, basic level, like, yeah, we're measuring impression delivery, and then we're trying to, you know, gauge interest and engagement based off that quote unquote click. But, you know, the more that we explore this space and understand, you know, okay, there's value to delivering the right content to the right audience on the front end, but then what is the value of continuing to like deepen that content experience, and how does it change the standard of measurement? You know, so, you know, it's so much less about delivering that impression and delivering the message via the megaphone, so much more about turning all of this media into performance media. And you know, is that true for, you know, edit content or entertainment content the same way it is for ad sales content? I certainly see, at least in terms of measuring performance and TV becoming a performance medium, I mean, I think that there's less and less distinction to two, because, you know, like we say, we keep going back to the idea that having that real human interactivity, you know, that's ultimately the key. And it's also, I mean, from a delivery standpoint, and the onus falling on content creators to, you know, be undoing biases and having a diversity and inclusion in their content. It also gives us the chance to kind of, you know, not to slam Nielsen or anything, but I'm going to slam Nielsen really quick. Is like, instead of having a mild suggestion that this content is landing with people, we now have the ability to kind of turn around and reverse engineer and say, we developed this content, you know, we're doing our best from a delivery standpoint to remove bias. And now we're able to see down to the actual individual who is interacting with that content from a demographic standpoint. But then, you know, really building, you know, those cross-platform posts and experiences with those specific users in mind. So there's a lot of really interesting, you know, information to be gleaned there, and a lot of optimization that can be gleaned there based on, you know, who's the real human being on the other side of that watching experience.
Totally. And Jennifer, sorry, before you jump in also, just one more quick pile on that. We've seen what's happened in the last 2.5 years because of the pandemic open our eyes to different opportunities around what content we produce. And this is everywhere, local, state, national, global level. I think that's the other idea is if your content isn't smart in the background, if you're not utilizing intelligent content practices and being aware of it, the problem is then you're just going to have a dumb asset that you don't know what to do with when that opportunity does arise. And that's, I think, the other kind of pitch, you know, for, hey, you should be thinking about this because dumb content won't work in a smart chain. And I'm sorry to put that so crudely. But
let's go back a little bit to some of the ethical implications. Lingling, I'd love to hear from your perspective as what are some of the biggest ethical implications of intelligent content?
Sure. I know in the past, for traditional broadcast, is one way, and we have programmed there and waiting audiences or waiting viewers to dial in. But now, recent years, we pay more attention to interactivities. So this availability and accessibility really become a focus. So online, use the internet-based distribution, you know, the accessibility, and become a big issue in a recent year, and broadcasters pay more attention to it to make it work. And add to what Guy just said, you know, if you have a piece of content, if not searchable, if not surfaced, if not detectable, then the content will lose its meaning. And for the search capabilities and, you know, search engine optimization and everything, you know, broadcasters, all content creators, distributors are working on, put a lot of effort to it. You have to use this, you know, intelligent content tools available and pick the right tools and to help you to reach, you know, your potential. And when we talk about, you know, ethical implications, of course, the replace jobs is more people more talking about it. And I think we want to talk about or consider of the fundamental principle that AI intelligent content as media shouldn't harm humanity and efforts should be made to minimize its negative impacts on people. Back to you, Jennifer.
Yes, thank you. And so that kind of leads us to what are some of the things that we can do to ensure that that's happening.
I think to go back on one thing that I was mentioning earlier is having all these different voices at the table, because I think there's a tendency to believe that one code of ethics or one code of morality is everybody's code of morality. And that's just not the case. By having more voices at the table on the content creation side, but also the data analysis side, you are being able to get a variety of ideals, a variety of morals, a variety of ethics in there. So it's not just the stories and the culture that we're telling, but also the moralities, different moralities, not just, you know, we like to use the word Western morality or Western ideals, but there's so many different ideals. I mean, you can see how divided just the US is right now. Having those different voices at the table so that you do create something that is more nuanced or do analysis of something in a more nuanced way than having a very small subset of like-minded.
Absolutely. And thank you, Stephanie, for jumping in on that. Chad, I'd love to hear from you about not just the ethical implications, but what we can do about some of them.
Sure. Yeah. Stephanie mentioned 21st century disciplines, so the change function. And Guy had mentioned intelligent content, you know, methodologies or intelligent content practices, I believe is what he said. So there is a change function here. So a lot of the common theme that underlies what we're talking about is the fact that sometimes technology evolves faster than we can to adapt to it. And sometimes we have to catch up to what the technology can do and sort of align with its promise and its purpose. I had a thought, which was I had sort of an out-of-body experience during the Oscars this year. So stay with me on this one, right? So Will Smith gets up and he slaps Chris Rock. I believe 10 years ago, the broadcast would have cut to a commercial very quickly. They would have come back. Will Smith would have not been in the audience anymore. And most people would understand why and agree with it. However, what happened, at least in my experience, why it was out of body for me is suddenly it's all everyone's talking about on social. For me, it was Twitter. And pretty soon, not only is it a raging inferno of thoughts and opinions, but it's being explored from literally every possible angle. And I don't know about you all, but by the next day, I was confused about basic right and wrong. Like, I didn't know what morality was because I had every shade of gray had been explored. You know, maybe there is an obligation as a man that should protect your loved ones. Maybe there is, you know, but maybe it's completely wrong. But I think we're living in a really strange time where the concept of truth is what's being challenged. And in some ways, that's good because you're seeing a much broader diversity of thoughts and opinions and not such narrow thinking. But on the other side of that is the inundation, can just numb us. And in the case of the Academy Awards, it was all everybody talked about for 3 or 4 days, and then it was completely burned out. And my view is it just left everybody confused. And I think we're seeing that phenomenon kind of across the board, not just with that event, but with how thoughts and opinions are being shaped and how civil discourse is changing, or discourse in general is changing, and how we're being fragmented around information and content. So I think the idea, it begins with a culture and a media organization. I think it's been brought up a couple times. It's, yes, there need to be smart content practices. There need to be new disciplines with how organizations operate in order to serve the purpose of content and to also define what that purpose is. But I think it begins there. I mean, these are really big, lofty end concepts at play here. These are about kind of how we evolve culture and the role of content in evolving, you know, culture. And it's even as deep as, you know, we've had a pretty profound fall off in Western democracy measurably over the last 10 years or so. And, you know, I think, again, these are big, grand ideas, but, you know, democracy is such an aberration in history. If you look at the overall 100 plus billion people that have ever lived, a very small portion of them over a very finite period of time have lived with any presumption of sort of liberty or personal freedom. And we find that without the ability for there to be a design and a good purpose, a moral purpose behind how content is served and created and how it's ultimately used and curated, we find that we you know, things that we take for granted can change extraordinarily quickly. So again, I think it begins with organizations understanding the role and responsibility they have to not just allow the algorithms to take them to, you know, growth and consumption where that becomes the metric, but there's some other cultural purpose and principles and morality at play within the organization. And that should guide the disciplines, that should guide the practices that follow.
So you're talking about intention and you're talking about ethics and how these rest with the companies that are using this data and that are using these technologies. But what are some of the ways these companies can actually be using these data to create diversity and to create inclusion so that, you know, like Steph, you were talking about getting more voices to people and how that helps shape an organization's goals?
I think a big one is through analysis. I was actually listening, ironically, there was an AI conference this morning by the Swiss Cognitive Group. So it was a great morning to like listen in on some AI. It was called the Global Green Deal. And they were talking, one example that they used was how data analysis was used on an algorithm. I want to say it was LinkedIn, but I could be wrong, where they had taken all of these CVs and they put them together. So the algorithm was going through and trying to find ideal candidates based on candidates that had been hired for these jobs. And it, once they did the analysis of this, that women were being excluded from these jobs, not realizing, I feel like saying internal or this bias is a drinking game now, but not realizing that they had this bias during hiring, where the algorithm had picked that up just based on the successful candidate. So anytime the woman or the word women's anything, women's sports, women, they were, you know, a soccer player for a women's soccer team or what have you, was mentioned, then that CV was thrown out. So going back and checking your algorithm often, doing the data analysis, like Ling Ling said, I think is a good way of getting at that. But like Chad was saying too, you've got to define what your mission is for whatever you know, group that you're in, whatever media corporation, whatever your mission is, you need to make sure that your data analysis is aligning with that continuously. Because your mission and my mission and someone else's mission may not be the same thing, and that's okay. But you want to have some kind of like shared pathway in that mission. And then does your analysis support that?
You know, I think we could just keep talking about this probably all day. There is just so much to explore. We're in the last quarter of our hour here, though, and I'd love to have all of us kind of move on to also talk about how intelligent content affects the workplace, both in terms of like a safer environment or how to make sure that our workplace isn't going to be replaced or impacted in a negative way, displacing jobs, et cetera. So let's do a little bit of a shift and let's jump on that. And Guy, would you like to go first?
Okay. Actually, you know what? Maybe I'm going to defer to some of the experts on this one and chime in as well. I just don't want to start down a path and dominate the conversation.
So Guy has a lot to say, but all right. Okay. So Chad, do you want to kick this one off?
Could you maybe define, I'm a little not resonating with that right off the bat. So how content is able to, on an institutional basis?
We're talking about how intelligent content can affect things such as workplace safety, you know, on the content creation thing. And then also things like ensuring that our workforce isn't necessarily just replaced.
I'm confused by how intelligent content could. I mean, I understand the motivation for those outcomes, but
I might have something.
Yeah, go right ahead.
This is like small and kind of silly, but I remember a few years ago being at another seminar that was talking about you know, automated media buying, you know, which I know isn't necessarily in the same vein as intelligent content, but there is a point. The big question was, if we suddenly make everything automated and we rely on machine learning and algorithms to do everything for us, what's the point of an account executive or a media planner or anything like that? And, you know, that was a question that really stuck with me. And I saw a really interesting resolution to it that, you know, at least in my space, you know, we have seen people who are starting to become online to offline specialists. So instead of, you know, being decidedly in a content creation role that or media planning role or something that may ultimately end up phased out given the evolution of the space, there's a lot of like new analysis that is coming out that is requiring new manpower. There's a lot of thought leadership that's taking place in the at least in the QR space that we're seeing, and it's not necessarily something that I can speak to in terms of workplace safety or anything like that. But as the space evolves, I think it's creating new creative and interesting roles that don't necessarily mean we're replacing anybody, but maybe repurposing.
And where I was going to go, just I think this will also help Chad in terms of where he was going as well. So, you know, we have DEI, right? Diversity, equity, inclusion, right? Those have been, you know, it started out with just D and I, right? It was just diversity and inclusion. And then we brought equity to the table as Black Lives Matter exploded. But honestly, these are things that have resonated since, you know, the beginning of the civil rights movement, since suffragette, right? These are age old things that are finally becoming part of our everyday life. And I think there's two that are missing. And this is why I wanted to throw this out there, because first of all, you've got accessibility. And I think that's the other important part where we sometimes miss that. And it's not accessibility comes down to things like, it comes down to your mood and your personality. Are you an ADD type of person, whether it's diagnosed or not, right? Accessibility is important. So I wanted to make sure that was thrown out there. And I think there's a lot of work that we can do to make our content more accessible for more people. And that also speaks to the localization business, and also just trying to bring it, because accessibility also has to do with language, has to do with hearing. Et cetera. And then the final one on top of that with DEI, and I add an A and I add a B, Because the other is belonging. Because how many times have you been to an event and you're like, oh, I fluted, but I don't feel like I really belong. And I think those are the other things where if you think of DEIAB in general, it is a big impact in terms of your corporate culture, in terms of the product that you make, in terms of your community, in terms of your consumer. And I think ultimately, as we think about our position, our unique position as humans inside of this grand digital ecosystem, we have to go back to those fundamentals, because that's the part where we have to train these machines. We have to train the algorithms properly. And that's the part where if we don't start at least with that as a foundation, you know, it doesn't matter what group you're going to bring together. If they're not thinking about those things, you're going to end up down, the wrong path, so to speak. So I just wanted to throw those out there. I think kind of echoing what you said, Megan, and also opening it up, because, you know, if you think about inauthentic content, where are you going to go to find out whether or not this content is authentic? You're going to have to trust that body, that, whatever it might be, that says, oh, by the way, this is real. And that's another part where DEIAB plays into that, because how can you trust somebody if you don't feel included, if you don't feel like you belong, and you don't feel like, hey, I can get to that information quickly. So just throwing that out there, Jennifer, sorry.
Yeah. I just want to add to what Guy said. I think from a media ecology perspective, and when we look at media ecology, involve a couple of disciplines and people and media, which is a technology, and also content. Now, add on to that, I think, is the governance. So we do need to put governance and a policy on top of that and to manage it. And for workplace safety, you know, recent years and last decade, so many things change. So on-the-job training, and for employer encourage on-the-job training, workforce development, and, you know, a changing pace of the work, and also, you know, look at, I just remind me an example, like from analog to digital conversion. At time, analog, we have one channel only, but with automation, with a digital transition, we provide more services with multi-channels, but with the same amount of people. So that said, is as long as we balance everything, and we will need to generate more content. So there are plenty of job to do. It's just a different way to do it.
Ling Ling, those are very good points. And I was just about to ask you to chime in there. So thank you. So really, we're talking about accessibility. And as Ling Ling said, governance and backing that up with actual policy. So what does this mean for the future of our industry? I'd love to hear from each of you on what you think the biggest issue is that we need to consider now for a better future.
I just make a point about the job replacement through automation. I think, you know, I think probably most of us are familiar with the philosopher Thomas Malthus, who at the end of the 19th century had predicted that humanity would essentially consume agriculture faster than we could plant, and that we would eat ourselves out of our resources. And of course, what happened is there was great innovation in planting and harvesting and crop genetics. And of course, that didn't come to be. And I think we've seen that same phenomenon with process improvements in business. Typically, there's a lot of fear that, you know, it's all going to be automated. We're going to be displaced. We're now slave to the robot. And that's never really the case. What happens is new industry, new opportunity blossoms to the degree that people are refocused to higher value work. So I think with the fact that we have the ability to create more data and harness more data through more efficient process really helps shape and evolve future business models, future engagement models. We now see the emergence of what will be an experience layer on the internet that is called the metaverse. And, you know, we're constantly pushing into new things and new possibilities. And, you know, frankly, the process improvement portion of that, the automation improvement, simply makes that possible. Because if you had to focus all of the talent on the more mundane, replicable, automatable tasks, we wouldn't push into those new frontiers as fast.
And absolutely. I will say, you know, availability, and if we need what do you think is the biggest issue? we need to consider for a better future, I think, is the availability. You know, democratizing access to artificial intelligence and intelligent content is the first step toward a better future. Having said that, the example is natural language processing. You know, large language model cost so much, and how to make those developer deploy those in the real world, I think that's a the availability issue.
Yeah, maybe an esoteric thought, but I'm thinking maybe we have to have a think about the definition of intelligence as well, because we're talking about intelligent content. Well, some of the smartest, most intelligent people I know of are the ones that manipulate markets, for example, through algorithms. That's certainly intelligent, but I would hope that we redefine intelligence around inherently having some type of moral or beneficial purpose outside of merely being effective in an outcome, even if that outcome is detrimental.
That's a great point, Chad. And Megan, did you have anything you wanted to say about what you thought this issue is we need to look at right now?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think the biggest thing is getting over a reticence to change, and also, you know, opening ourselves up to, I shouldn't say ourselves, but publishers and content creators opening themselves up to the ugly truth that maybe their content currently right now today isn't the best received, and making changes accordingly. You know, there's steps that people can take right now to make sure that they are putting out unbiased content, measuring the response, and really kind of getting themselves into that mentality of, you know, this has been a passive industry who, you know, I mean, we have ethical issues across the board when it comes to messaging. And How do you start right now holding yourselves accountable for that? You know, it's about kind of taking that first step into peeling back the layers and not relying on Nielsen viewership and not waiting until content is served via algorithm anyway. It's like, you know, while we still have brain power running it, we should be working out the kinks now.
Absolutely. And Stephanie, you've spoken a lot about the need to bring diverse voices to the table, but was there anything you wanted to add to that in our very short time remaining here?
Yeah. From an educational perspective, I could say one thing that we need stronger or to do better is stronger ties between industry and the students that are coming up now that are creating this content. Because I think that conversation with would create much, or would create a lot of innovation in ways that would be less scary on both sides. I think students are afraid to go out and potentially fail because they're not making traditional content and not, you know, daring to say what they think and what they want and their innovative ideas, and vice versa. So I think opening up conversations between industry and students, if that's in the form of internships or guest speaking or what have you, that would go a long way to. There's always room for more voices at the table. To borrow a Swedish saying, there's enough sugar for everybody, right?
So, I love that.
Yeah. It's a book I read to my kids when they were small. But yeah, bring all these voices to the table, get these conversations going, and see how we can innovate. There's always enough sugar for everybody.
That is a really great note, I think, for us to end on. There is so much more to talk about. I think keep going for a long time, and I'm sorry to have to close this down today, but I want to say thank you to everyone who's been listening along. Thank you to Cognizant sponsoring the event, and then thank you, each of our speakers, Chad Andrews with Cognizant, Stephanie Dean, Assistant Professor of Mass Communication, University of Monte Carlo, Guy Finley, President and CEO of Mesa, Megan Glenn, Media Sales Director at Flowcode, and Lingling Sun, Chief Technology Officer at Nebraska Public Media. I think you've all had some really, really great insights to share. I hope everyone has enjoyed listening along. And big thank you to NAB Amplify for hosting.
Thank you, Jennifer.
Thank you, Jennifer.
Thank you, Jennifer.
Thank you, Emma.
Thank you, guys. Thank you. That was an amazing chat. Really fascinating stuff. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Lovely. Have a great day, everyone.
Thank you.
Bye-bye now.
Bye.